years ago. And you know, have you ever been to Tipton?
Yes.
You know that little Spooks Nook?
Yep,
that,
yep.
Well, O.A. Nelson had let the concession to some young couple, and they were going to rent rooms. And we walked in there, looking around, and I saw all of this old ledger torn in there, and
in
I
the
picked
wood
up
box.
In the wood box, and I picked up a piece, and I saw
in the wood box.
It were the meetings of the Arctic Brotherhood, the beginning of it in Chittenden.
Is that right?
And I said, "If I," I said, "What are you going to do with it?" She said, "Well, I needed the rest of this ledger for the hotel for the guests to be signing." And I said, "If I bring you some newspaper, may I sort this over?" So I spent quite a little time. I sorted every one of those, and I have them all in order. It's the very first meeting of the Arctic Brotherhood in Chittenden. And it's real fun. It tells about what they paid for cuspidors and this thing. And pretty soon it said, O.A. Nelson was the one that owned all of them. He's a millionaire finally on the stock. Anyway, it said blackballed O.A. Nelson. O.A. Nelson blackballed. Well, then it went along about pretty soon. O.A. Nelson had bought the Arctic Brotherhood building. And then another meeting or two, O.A. Nelson admitted to membership. That has to go to the archives.
Yeah, oh, that's
good. Nobody else has that. That I know nobody else has.
Yeah.
But that handwritten old paper, you know, supposing I hadn't gotten that.
Oh, it would have been burned.
Supposing not, then nobody would have that. And that is an actual history of that era.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you about that in this story. And Bert Cameron and Jamie. Jamie came first from Hawaii, and then Bert came. Bert had had some law school training. And my father had let Art use the cabin next to us, you know, because he was very interested in education and interested in the young. And he was a very fine person with a lot of idiosyncrasies. Anyway, the boys used that when they came into town to go to the dances to clean up. Now, you either bought your water from the waterman, or you brought the snow in and melted it on this stove, you see. Well, Art was theoretically the master of the house because it had been given to Art, but they all came. So Bert Cameron came in this time, and he took his bath and was going to dress, and he threw his BVDs over Art's dish towel.
His shorts.
Well, they were BVDs in those days.
Yeah,
that's right.
So Art was affronted. Art has always been very meticulous in that way. So it made Jewel so mad, because anything that makes his brother mad, it makes him mad. So he was making divinity candy, and it was just at that nice sticky stage, you know. So he scooped a big gob of it up with his spatula and put it inside the crotch of the BVDs.
Wiped it off and
smeared the whole inside of this. Bert Del Cameron came in, he put those on, he never said one word, and he wore them to the dance. Now, which one was taken, was Jewel and Art, or was Bert?
Bert danced all evening.
Was that all of that sticky divinity fudge inside of his DVDs? Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear.
Bert would look off into space and he'd say, "To it, one Bert L. Cameron."
And he was real good looking, and the girls fell for it in droves, and the rest of them were too. They were just delighted, you know, to do something a little bit ornery to Bert Cameron. But can you imagine anybody thinking of doing that to a person's DVDs?
I didn't look terribly resentful. I just gave Jewel a kind of a wry look.
But Jewel came to Jewel
grabbed the spatula and got this.
Oh, dear. But those were rugged days. You know, we always had our dates for Saturday night, and unless you were a wallflower, you nearly had all your dances taken. That's why you could shuffle around these.
Yeah.
So,
I was a very meticulous cook in those days. I'd dump a couple of raw eggs into a granite bowl, a couple of spoons of sugar and some canned milk, whip it up, and then I'd eat French bread and butter and drink that soup. And then I'd rinse out the bowl and wipe it out with a dish towel. So that's what all I used the dish towel for.
But I can imagine how you'd feel with some of these BVDs thrown over.
Well, that's all that was on the line, about 12 feet across the room, with that one little towel hanging close together, and why he couldn't miss it with it.
Yeah.
astounded me.
Well, then, did you continue on in the university? Just, you entered.
I hung around there 5 years and finally gave up. I could not entertain analytical geometry, and I flunked it 3 times.
He was short, just those analytical geometry.
I guess that's all that I was short. Yeah. But I just couldn't consider it. I wasn't interested in it. I knew I was going to flunk, but I stuck it out anyhow. I never wanted to be a quitter. But I was positive several months before I left for the end of the year that I wasn't going to make it.
Yeah.
But I don't like to be a quitter. I never did. When I was driving tractor and my brother Jules helper with me, we got, the road led through some big cottonwood trees along the Shulitna, and it was worn down into the dirt a foot. And those Holt tractors didn't have the roller flanges on the inside, just on the outside of the track. So if the track tipped a little bit, the shoes were 2 feet wide on each track. Mm-hmm. They'd tip a little bit, the weight of the tractor would slide it one way or the other, and then the sprocket would lock on the rail of the track, and there you were. Well, I was going through that soup a foot of it, and I couldn't see how she was doing down in those ruts. It was all flooded from a big rain. And the tractor climbed the sprocket climbed the rail of the track and just killed the engine. There she was, and I couldn't move it. I got the engine going and yanked it back and forth for an hour, teams both sides of that place waiting to get by. And I had an old homemade wrench, about a 2 foot handle on it, and I stuck that down between the rail and the sprocket in the mud, couldn't see anything. And I give it a good jerk with the engine again, and it pulled the track over, and I crawled out of there. But while I was doing that, Jules says, "Oh, let's leave her right here. It's a good place for it," he said. "Let's get out of here and go get our time." "No," I says, I'll get fired, but I won't quit." And another time again, we were crossing the railroad track and just gone through, and the tractor was tipped up like this on a slant. Uh-huh. She locked her track again. About a half mile from the camp, and we were hungry as a dickens. Jules said, "Let's leave her right here. It's a good place for it, right on the track. Come on, let's go get her supper and quit." No, I said, "I can't do it." Finally got it out of there.
Well, when you, after you went to the university then, what did you do? Did you work for the FE company or?
No, I borrowed a couple thousand from Judge Monell and bought a tractor and sledge.
From whom? Tell her.
From Harold Gillum. We were fighting fire in the flats there between the road and the farm road. There was a little fire drifting in the moss there. It should have been left alone. But Larry Palmer, in charge of biological survey with the reindeer down in the flat, got a big breaking plow and Gillum for $50 a day. And Gillum sat on that tractor looking back at me and slowly idling along in low gear, and I'm sweating in the hot sun and fighting that braking plow as it swings back and forth. Put in a good strenuous day there, and I got to think and say, he's doing better than I am. And I talked with him and I found out he wanted to go flying, so I bought him out. And then several years later I bought out Gene McQuinn and Bill McCann's similar tractor with their wagons and sleds, and I took over their ore hauling in Esther Dome then, so I was quite busy.
Also money from Bunnell. Bunnell was awfully
good.
Oh yes,
good. I borrowed a second time and I hadn't paid him off the first yet. And all he did was say, "Let's see if I have it," and he looked in his checkbook. "Yes, I think I can do it." So I got the second.
He was awfully good to us, you know, and I'd be in the library, he'd come along and drop a few lunch tickets, and nobody knows what that means, you know, carrying cold lunches in a cold weather, to be able to go into a lunchroom and have a hot meal.
He was a good man.
Yes, he was a controversial person, but a privilege to have known.
Well, he was kind of father to all of us.
He meant
well for all of us.
And he felt like we were each one his children. He was the type of man that wanted to be the bride at the wedding and the corpse at the funeral, the whole thing. He was so keyed into everything. I've always played from him when we'd sit around and sing, and he'd hurry down to his house and bring back his trombone. He wanted to be in with a part of everything.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, then, did you go to the university for how long were you at?
Five half days, and then I taught 1 year, and then I married. And that then started raising a family.
You say 5 half days.
5 half days. Well, five years of half days.
Oh.
I never did go full days.
You didn't?
No, because I gave music lessons. I'd always have to come home at noon, which didn't allow me in a lot of college living, you know. Mm-hmm. But that was all right. And managed fine. And then I did teach the 1 year, and then Art and I were married, and
then did you live after you're married? Where did you live?
I was building a house up on 10th Street. It's still there. Rudy Voigt lives in it with motor-in garages.
I know where that is.
Mm-hmm. And I built a number of other buildings around there. So
first you dug a basement and you lived in the basement.
Yeah, the first one I lived in the basement.
Before we were married.
With a rough floor on and a load of sawdust on top. And I had a big drum in the basement and I slept up on the bank. I had a little hole in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Then you built a garage and lived in the garage.
Yeah,
and then you built a house. And then you came to school one time, one Friday afternoon, and you said to me, "This is it. Either we are married tonight, or we won't be married ever." I was having a hard time making up my mind. And we'd been going together almost 5 years, but I couldn't quite decide I wanted to get married.
She had quite a lot of help against me. I wasn't too popular. I was kind of an ornery cuss, brash, and ill-mannered.
But he built this warm house, and he said, "I'm going to build it so warm," because I had lived in this awfully cold house, "that if I light a candle in July, there'll still be some heat in January." And by Jove, about was. Now, it was, when you finish college, you don't have any money.
Yeah.
And so we heated that house, not terribly comfortably in the further reaches, with a kitchen stove.
That's all we had was
the kitchen stove.
And the far corner of the front room in 60 below would be about 60 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But we managed, and you know, we were on a cash and carry basis. Art was paying off money for those the tractors and all, and you had what you could pay for.
Mm-hmm.
You never went into debt for anything. And it means that come what may, no matter how old you aren't afraid. You know you can manage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to, if this isn't within reach, there's something else that will be, you see.
So then you stayed in that house, you lived there until you left here in 1947.
That's right. Uh-huh. By that time, he had built 9 houses and dug walk-in tunnels, concrete tunnels, bought the engine of the old Idler, which was the pleasure boat of Frank Noyes, who was one of the early day people that really had money.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd set up this boiler that furnished steam, heat, and water to all these houses, walk-in tunnels. I remember when he bought that boiler, they said, "Art, you can't do that. That you just can't do that. That can't be done."
Were they the houses all near each
yes,
other?
Yes, sort of around in a circle.
There was 9 besides the garage, so I was heating 10 buildings. And one December, I spent $30 for fuel. I got screenings under the coal bunkers for $3 a ton, and I'd tell them that's all sand. You better cut that in half or something, and I'd get better weights out of the fellas.
Yeah.
At one time, Cap Lathrop had a whole carload of screenings they had cleaned up and loaded there with some equipment, and he wanted to sell it to me. And I said, "No, I wouldn't pay anything for it. I'll take it and haul it up to my place and burn it, but it isn't worth it." So I got it under those conditions, and I had a wood bin at that time made out of planks, and the darn stuff set the bin afire by spontaneous combustion.
Holy smoke.
It was quite dry when I hauled it, but I think some rain water got in it, or snow water, and it heated up. And Brother and I were singing our heads off at the piano one evening, and somebody told me the garage was on fire.
Which meant heat for all the buildings. But he managed it. Nothing permanently.
Did the garage burn down?
No.
It burned the roof. Let's see, it had 12-inch spruce shiplap on the ceiling and 10 inches of sawdust and then galvanized iron. Well, it burned that shiplap on the ceiling and also on the walls, so it was just about ready to drop, but it was still strong enough to hold up the sawdust. And I got by with it for a year or two, and then I came up from the States and put a new roof on, about 48. And I had lots of, half a dozen kegs of nails, half or three quarters full, down in the boiler room. But you know, I nailed all that shiplap on that six stall garage with bent nails, used nails. I was so thrifty, I wanted to use them up.
That well, that's but the background.
The fire didn't damage the boiler, so you were able to.
No, it didn't hurt the boiler.
Yes, it was just,
it just burned the wall pretty hard between the coal bin and the garage, and then it spread over the ceiling and the end walls. It burned up our Buick car and quite a lot of tar paper and building material and tools and a nice 30-30 rifle. Oh, I had a lot of junk in there that got burned.
What model was the Buick? What year?
31.
Oh.
I bought a 31 pickup that year. We dug the courthouse basement that year. And I bought that Buick, traded wood for lots of it to Paul Grimond. Mm-hmm. And the Model A pickup, which I liked very much. A little four-cylinder, and it could make 55 miles an hour. And it's quite sprightly for that day.
You betcha.
It was barter and trade. Practically all the babies were paid for hauling wood to the nuns at the hospital.
Yeah, I haul a lot of wood to the hospital to pay for the kids.
Well, you have four children then.
We have four children.
Mm-hmm. When were they born?
Well, one was born in 1929 and 31 and 33, and then the trailer came along in 46.
Little Teddy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, which was great. Great.
The kids chew dentine.
But, no, I don't want to. But another...
Like a Coke or coffee or something?
I won't.
After this tape runs out, I'll let you go home and get some sleep. I'm enjoying this.
Do you know another very interesting thing? The way that people happened into this college. My mother went out in 21 and came back in 22. She had been very ill. Coming back was a young man by the name of Charlie Wheeler. And mother got to talking to him and telling her that I was going on to college and the college was opening. Charlie had had practically no schooling. He'd been kind of battered around and had gone into the Navy as a very young man. So he made one night $1,400 gambling on the railroad. He was working on the railroad. So he came to town and looked my mother up, and she said, well, you better go to school. You should. And education is a very important thing. So he went out and talked to Bunnell. Bunnell says, well, I can't let you into school here. You go to high school. You go a year to high school, and we'll see that you get into college. So with no education, maybe he had had maybe a fourth grade, he took all of his high school in one year. I wrote all his English themes and did all these things because he couldn't have made it. But he was almost a genius in math. And also with that one year, the happenstance of being with my mother on this boat coming home, he went out to college and was a far better math in math than some of the professors, like the man in calculus.
Oh, our instructor knew absolutely nothing about calculus.
But Charlie did. Mm-hmm. And I wrote his English themes through college because it was a rough go with no educational background. He finished here. He went back to Bucknell, which was Bunnell's college, and he wound up as a government labor relations for many, many, many years. Now, this happenstance, he was mining over with his uncle over in the Kantishna country and probably would have done nothing else. This happenstance, Bunnell's keen interest and concern, and nearly everybody that went out there was given something to make money. And sometimes I know he created the jobs because I have seen times when people were moving something one place and then somebody else was hired to move it back when these kids couldn't possibly have done other than that. Mm-hmm. And that is something that it will never be again, unfortunately, Mike. There won't be the concern for one individual for another individual.
If it hadn't been for a person like Dr. Bunnell, the college might never have started, or maybe not have existed.
I don't think so. I don't think anybody would have
failed on someone else.
I don't think anybody would have put in his money. And now, he had been a teacher, and of course he'd been a judge, and he knew how to manage that recalcitrant legislature, you see.
He'd go down there and talk them out of money, and he had
that nobody else could do. And there were many people going out there. Many things that happened that people were most unhappy about, but on the right side of the ledger, the big things, there was nobody like him. Mm-hmm. It was in the little things that he might have fallen down. But he was a great man for those beginning years of college. And I think Bill Cashin did a great job on his book.
I'm sorry to admit that I haven't read his book yet.
And I want to talk to Bill, as long as he's gotten those early years of those political shenanigans, he better do a book on nothing but those political shenanigans, because they were terrifically interesting.
We enjoyed it very much because we knew him so well.
Yes.
And through this political setup and the fact that Dad was in it, we got to meet everybody that came here. All of the people that drifted through here somehow or other would wind up at our house. Mother had the ability to make a house a gracious place. Florence and I played, and those were the days that if you were asked to do anything, you said, yes, we will. And when I went outside, it almost wore me out, because any time I was asked to do something, I would. And I was being used by all the program chairmen in Eugene, you see, because I was raised never to say no.
Yeah.
If you had any talent whatsoever, you used it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And people would come and sit, and we would play. Mother always would have something. It was a little oasis in many of these homes were for lots and lots of lonely people. Terribly interesting people.
An unusual home.
It was an unusual background.
Mm-hmm.
Very unusual background.
This growth now is something to see when you think back how it was in the 20s.
I remember one time we came back, you know, everybody loved us. Because we were there weren't that many little children here.
Mm-hmm.
And we came back before the line was gone. And Art had borrowed Bill Green's car, and I was walking down 4th Avenue. Well, out came Dave Sanford, the darling old black fellow who had learned ship caulking in the Barbados and had been around here all my life. Well, he saw me go by, and he said, "One of the Roth girls." Well, here I was, you know, a very mature Roth girl. And out came Black Lena, who'd been on the line, and she came over. They both grabbed me, were crying, and Art went by with this car, and he didn't even stop. He said, "I was just too ashamed. Here you were with those two, one from the line, and this other fellow." All three of us crying.
Wasn't she Julina?
Was she Julina?
Called Julina, I think so.
Was she? Well, whatever she was, but three of us had a crying good time. They were so glad to see me, and I was equally glad to see them.
Well, I admit I was bewildered.
So bewildered you kept on going and pretending you didn't know.
That's what she says. I'm not sure,
yes,
but it or not.
Well, to go back to before 1922, did you attend the Cornerstone Lane at the university?
No, I didn't, because the actual getting out from Fairbanks that was 4 miles, and it had to be. I just didn't get there.
That was in 1917, wasn't it?
Yes, I'm sure. So I have the picture, and this Margaret Murray, whom you have met, her little brother and sister were the ones that officiated at the groundbreaking, and Paul Krebs, that I used to go to some of the dances with, was the signal corps here, and he's in that picture.
A very handsome young soldier, well-dressed. He gave me a muskrat fur cap, and I was sure happy when it finally wore out that skull in my head for years.
But those early days, now, for instance, there was this darling John Luss, who had been a deserting seaman. He was a lad from Riga, and had deserted
a Russian steamer here, so he had no port of entry at all. But he wandered in here, and he wandered out here and went to college and was doing all right. A very intelligent, darling person. He used to come in and see Florence and myself, and if we'd be washing, you know, up with a washboard, why, he'd always take over, just push us away. And I was so embarrassed because I would have brassieres and panties in there, you know, and here would be John Luss washing. And in those days, nobody ever touched anything like that. In fact, you hung them, you hung your sheets here and things here, and then your intimates in between, you know. Yeah. But John, he'd hand them up, oh, he'd say, you know, no, and didn't think a thing about it. And then he wanted papers. He wanted his
citizenship.
So he talked it over with President Medell, and he went back trying to get a port of entry. And nobody ever heard from him again. And he was the darlingest little man. He had that cute little log, sort of a lean-to shed that he used to bring, invite the ones of us, the fortunate ones, up for a hot meal once in a while.
Well, just never heard of him again.
When he got past New York, he was trying to get by the customs. He told the man he wanted to come into the country, and the man says, "I don't know what I can do
this
for you."
This was when he entered.
Yeah, when he entered, and the official pulled open the drawer, and there were some small bills in there, and John Luss reached in his pocket and threw in one or two more, and the man said, "Well, I guess I can let you buy on something or other, you know." Mm-hmm. Just a couple of dollars was adequate.
Well, that was someplace in the 30s, and it was a real tragedy. Yeah. We had very interesting, some of those early people were terrifically interesting. Mm-hmm. And nearly all of the early professors were interesting because they wouldn't have come a long way away. The wives wouldn't have lived where the mechanics of living were so hard. They wouldn't have stayed where the plumbing was outdoors, yes, and you hauled in your water and carried out a slop jar, you know. Mm-hmm. So they had to be rather interesting people.
Do you remember some of the professors you had?
Oh, yes, yes.
Name some of them.
Well, the first, the one in the home economics department was Elizabeth Kirkpatrick, who afterwards was Mrs. Peter McMullen. Mm-hmm. And she was just a lovely, lovely person.
Wasn't Overshiner one of the first
ones? No.
He came a little later.
Yes, he came a little bit later. Morgan was there.
Morgan.
And Ladessa Nordale.
Bruce.
And the one year he taught here was the one and only year he ever taught. I wonder what you people did to it. I didn't take chemistry till the next year.
We were very fond of Bruce.
Bruce was a darling.
And Archie M. Truesdale.
And Truesdale was here. And Earl Pilgrim.
And Earl Pilgrim?
They were all here.
And what did Ladessa Nordale?
She was commercial. Mm-hmm. And Leslie Marchand was the English department.
Yeah.
And I think that he stopped at Priest's Bakery and had a cheese sandwich and one big cookie every day for lunch. And in the summer, when it got a little warm, why, he'd eat it on the cornerstone, and otherwise he'd eat it at a desk there.
A very precise, meticulous person.
Who afterwards did quite a little bit of writing and did very well. And, of course, Patty was in the first.
Oh, sure.
Ernest Patty. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there were eight. That first day, there were eight professors and six of us students. And, of course, then they began drifting in. Yeah. But it was an experience that probably will never be again.
If you come up again next summer, I know you don't have time this trip because you're leaving soon, but I'd love to get you together with Ruth Barrick and talk about some of the graduations and some of the people, because she has seen every graduation at the University of Alaska.
Isn't that amazing?
And I don't know how old Ruth is now, but she's getting up in years.
She came here as a widow. When I was in high school.
The Widow Wilson.
And I think that was about 1918. And I'll never forget that auto race that she went along as the mechanic.
All the money that was bet
on that race, they said that Bobby didn't push it hard enough because he wasn't going to make it too tough for the Widow Wilson, who was very charming. And so we lost the race, and there was many.
That was an automobile race.
Yes,
Model T's
round the ballpark.
I see.
Gibson had a special job there.
Yes, and old Joe Enos.
And Tom put too much crankcase oil in, and he had it in the so-called pit, warming it up for the race. And a cloud of oil smoke was going up there, and when the race was ready to start, his plugs were all fouled. Carlson from the NC had, I think, dual ignition, two magnetos or something, or the regular ignition plus a magneto added, and that went haywire. Joe Enos, with a little Model T, kept limping around, bumping around there, and I guess he was short two tires just on the rim. Crawling around in low gear, he won the race.
And there was lots of money put up in those days.
All
it was very exciting.
Blew up.
I'll tell you a cute story of Ruth Barrick. She went into the Cantation to buy boat with Dr. Sutherland. He had property up there, mining property, and he'd go in there, and she went along this time. She met, this must have been fall of the year, because there was snow. How she got in there. But anyway, she met Fanny Quigley, of whom you must have heard many things. And I knew very, very well. She was a friend of my mother and father's. Well, sirs, they met Fanny on the trail. And Ruth met Fanny on the trail. And the dogs went berserk. And Fanny says, "You know, my God, they've never seen a woman before." Yeah. But she came in 1918. And... I didn't realize she had been to every graduation.
She hasn't missed one.
I hadn't realized that.
And that's 51.
Mm-hmm.
1922's? Yeah, 51.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I hadn't realized that. But those were exciting times and interesting times, and they could never be again.
I'm going to try to talk to Ruth here. I've tried to get together with her, but it's pretty hard. She's going to Seattle, or she's... out at the lake or something, and it's just kind of difficult to make contact, but I'm going to keep pursuing it, probably after September, though, because I have to get out of town and do some roaming around and catching a few people here and there.
I had a lot of my classes